You've found the Fabric Podcast and the conversation we're calling Where There Is Hope. Does it feel like hope is easy for you personally? What about in the face of all of the big, even existential crises our society is facing? Let's take this time to cultivate a curiosity about hope and together try to see where there is hope.
Hey, good morning, everybody. For those of you who are with us on the live stream or listening to the podcast later, we're glad to have you here. Brian mentioned the good weather, too, and we've had this great break, but have you noticed, like, up until about, what, Thursday, Friday, how our conversation's obsessed on weather? We always talk about the weather, right? But, I mean, it's been kind of wild, crazy. People talking about the weather all the time, and just, you know, 6-8 weeks of, like, wet and cold and no sun, and, you know, like I said, we always do it, but I think there's something, these are tough times right now we're going through, and it's sort of like, I just don't need the weather to pile on it too, right? I mean, have you found yourself thinking that and talking about that? You're saying, if just we could have some nice weather, I just don't need bad weather to be piling on top of my trying to be hopeful, trying to be, you know, keep ahead of all this. And yeah, I think that has been something we've all been dealing with. I know I've said it. I know I've heard it a lot. So we're talking about hope these weeks here with Fabric, and it's as important, and hope is always hard. And today we have some challenging circumstances that are facing us that add just all kinds of dimensions to the need for hope. And I mean, it's almost become a matter of survival in a lot of places. And if you don't have hope, I mean, what have you done? Have you given up? We can't do that, right? We can't give up. We won't give up. I refuse to believe that we need to give up. And so how do we have hope? And we're spending time trying to wrestle that down a little bit. But we don't need the kind of hope that is just like, I sure wish things could be better, or I wish this would go away, or I'd like it to be, yeah, I mean, we all would, but it's not the wishful thinking kind of hope that we're looking for. The kind of hope that we're looking for is the kind of hope that there are always no guarantees. Hope is never certain. I mean, that's what its definition is. It's you don't know that it will happen, but by golly, there's something inside you. You've got a vision for it. And there's something that's going to drive you. And you're going to say, because I am willing to put myself into this and hopefully join hands with other people, it's a possibility, and I'm going to go for it. You know, so how does hope turn into reality? How did the hope for being able to light your house turn into an electric light bulb? In 1802, the light bulb was invented. You all knew that, I'm sure. But it was, like, not feasible. And it wasn't until 70-some years later that Thomas Edison, in all of his fun experimenting, decided to pick it up, right? So in the 1870s, that's almost three generations later from when the first glimmers of a light bulb were there, over three generations later that someone actually started doing with it. And Thomas Edison, I don't know if you've ever kind of got into his biography. He was just sort of a crazy, driven person that just did, you know, was merciless in trying to figure things out. But it says they say he tried some 3,000 theories on how to create a light bulb and something like 10,000 different models, you know, approaches to doing it until he found one that actually worked. You know, so it isn't. Well, and it was interesting. It's like pretty much everybody that was in his lab, everybody who was working alongside him had given this up as hopeless. Like, we tried everything. Nothing is feasible. It's a neat idea, but it doesn't work. Hope did not create a light bulb. But a light bulb probably would never have been made without hope. I think that's safe to say. Hope against, in this case, something that was considered impossible, not feasible, isn't going to happen. And the light bulb that was created then is a predecessor to the light bulb we have now, but it's considered outmoded technology, right? I mean, we don't have those kinds of light bulbs anymore. We went to CFLs and now to LEDs, and those have problems with them too, but we're on the way to something else, right? That's how it all happens. Now, you have all heard that hope is not a plan, and that's absolutely true. Hope is not a plan, but hope can have a plan. Hope can have a plan. And that's what I really want to explore today, is this possibility about hope having a plan. There is little, I think, that isn't worth pursuing when hope has and hope knows how to use a plan. We're going to actually be talking about that week and this week, but here's what I want to do today. First, I want to be perfectly honest with you about all of this. This hope stuff, this is hard for me. The stuff that I bring up here to talk to you about, it is never stuff that I've got figured out, mainly because those would be really, really short discussions. I mean, we talk about stuff. I bring stuff here that I, like, is driving me crazy. I don't know how to do this. I'm wrestling with it myself, and I look around the world, and it looks like I'm not the only one. So let's dig into this and start engaging this conversation as a community to try to do it. And believe me, hope is one of those for me. I do not have hope nailed down by any means. Now, I'm in delivery mode with you guys right now, pretty much on all Sundays, so I may come across as like really confident, like Greg's got this hope thing. And I don't feel that way around hope, but Greg's got it. He's all rah-rah for it. Yeah, you know, I probably do come across that way right now because that's what I'm doing. But it isn't like that. I really struggle with hope. I struggle with hope more now in this part of my life than probably any other time. But one thing I can tell you is I've been digging into, doing research around hope now for months before the series started, and one thing that I've learned that I take away that's become really important to me is what to do with my... all this research hasn't helped me, like, abolish my hopelessness. It hasn't gotten rid of all that stuff. What it's done is teach me what to do with my low points. See, hope has to go both uphill and downhill. I mean, there are times when, like, I feel courageous. I feel like everything is good. I've got all kinds of, you know, great feelings and support, and things are going the right way, and I'm just, like, coasting. It's like going downhill on my bike, the air streaming through. It's beautiful. And, you know, hope is easy. And then you get to the uphill stretch, and you're going slower and slower, and it's hotter, and you can't downshift in your gears any further, and it is just hard. You're just chugging uphill, and it feels hopeless. It feels hopeless. Hopelessness is a feeling. Hope is not. Hope is a mode that goes uphill and downhill. It's something you hold on to even when you're chugging uphill. Because you are feeling hopeless does not mean that there is not hope. It means that you are going uphill. You're probably doing some most important work. This is when you're problem solving. This is when you're pulling in other people. This is when you have that opportunity to realize how difficult the challenge is and what you're going to have to bring to it. Hope needs to be able to go uphill and downhill. And that's just an essential part of it. Okay, so that's one thing. I wanted to just share that honesty with you and let you know that, you know, if you get all this hope stuff right, you won't have problems with it anymore. No, you, by definition, will continue to have problems with it. And that's okay. That's part of hope. So that's one. Another part is, so I just want to start talking about how we begin to understand what a plan is and how we stick to it. And that's what we're going to be really working with for part of today and tomorrow or next week. But first, what I want to do is I want to back up and I want to start long, long ago with the Bible and do kind of a deep dive on something with you folks. And I'm doing this not because the Bible says it's right and we're supposed to follow it and do it. I don't think that is how the Bible works. I want to do it because what this story that I want to share with you today and I want to dig into really deeply is there because it tells us that this hope issue that we're feeling right now is not a new issue. In fact, it has been there as long as humans have existed. We have struggled. We have wrestled with hope. And while this community who decided that this story among them needed to be passed on to other people, why they did it is they couldn't uncomplicate hope for us. They couldn't turn it into something certain that will always have a happy outcome. Only Hollywood can actually do that, right? Real life doesn't do that. They didn't do it because of that, but they did it because they desperately wanted us to understand both how hard and how life-giving and how necessary hope can be. So I want to take you back to one of the very earliest stories of any civilization that we have recorded. And this is from Genesis chapter 22. It's the first 14 verses of this. And I want to just read it first. It's a tough story. I want you to listen to it, absorb it. You may know it, you maybe have never heard it before. And I want you to maybe even begin to wonder how this could possibly be a story of hope. After these things, God tested Abraham. God said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." God said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you." I told you it was a tough story. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, Abraham looked up, and he saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father Abraham, "Father." And he said, "Here I am, son." He said, "The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of Yahweh, "I am who I am," your Bible, English Bible will say the Lord, but it isn't a title, it's an actual name that was given. Yahweh means "I am who I am." But the angel of "I am who I am" called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." God said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "I am who I am will provide," Yahweh Yireh in Hebrew. "As it is said to this day, on the mount of I am who I am, it shall be provided." Yeah. Not a great bedtime story for your kids. I don't know, Heidi decided not to use that with the kids this week. You may be wondering, like, why is Greg using that one for Mother's Day? Well, it would be worse on Father's Day, just, okay? Wow, what a story, right? Let me back up a little bit so we can begin to understand what this story is actually kind of trying to tell us, because our 21st century minds just have no idea. I mean, all the obvious takeaways are horrible, right? I mean, you know, the big takeaway from the story is when your dad asks you to go for a hike, check to see what he's bringing along, right? You know, but it's not even going there, right? So one of the big things is we need to move out of our 21st century minds in order to understand what was going on and to, you know, enter into the culture that was there. And this is a good lesson for almost any time you're dealing with the Bible. So it's a good case in point for that as well. So this story was written at least 3,000 years ago, all right? And it was probably an oral tradition. It was an oral tradition for hundreds and hundreds of years before that. So this is a really old story among people who were so different from us in culture and language and understanding of the world and so on. So we need to realize that. This story fits into the sagas or the legends that peoples hold up to help them understand their history and their identity. It's telling them more about themselves than it is telling a story. Another thing we need to realize then, that this is kind of a brutal time in human history, right? I mean, this story, as outlandish as it was even then, was not nearly as outlandish as it sounded to us today. I mean, 3,500 years ago, I mean, think about what life was like and the sorts of things that might have been happening were current. If you think about the Grimm fairy tales, how many people read a unaltered version of the Grimm fairy tales to their kids? Those are less than 200 years old, right? So now go back 3,500 years ago and imagine how cultures pass on knowledge, pass on ideas, pass on the sort of stuff that you need to know who you are and what your life is about, okay? Another thing to know is that for the people who heard this, this was not a new story. We lived, Chris and I and our kids lived in Papua New Guinea for about 7 years. We were in a culture that would be in a lot of ways very similar to this. They're a pre-literate culture, pre-art, very unsophisticated technology. And so they spent a lot of time telling stories. You'd sit around the fire at night, and what do? But you tell stories. By the time you're 3, 4, 5, you have heard every story that your people have. And you have heard it many, many times. The point isn't hearing a new story and say, oh, I wonder what's going to happen. It's all in the storyteller. Who can tell the story to make it come the most alive? The best storyteller is the one that does not waste a word, does not waste a phrase, an expression, a detail. Everyone is in there for a purpose. If you think about trying to write this with some ink you had to make yourself on parchment too, 3,000 years ago, you don't waste space. Like, you put in there what you need to have in there, and that's it. So nothing is wasted. In our culture, with language and communication, we waste a lot. And that's just how it has evolved for us. So the other thing to then know about this is that this story was not an isolated story. It stands in the middle of a much, much larger narrative that started long before this story happened, and then that continues on. In fact, it continues on into the New Testament, the time of Jesus, a thousand or so years afterwards. So thinking about that, then thinking about this larger narrative, that's a good place to start to begin to understand this story. This is a story about a man named Abraham. You probably know Abraham. His name was originally Abram, right? Abram in Hebrew means great father, great ancestor. It's an important person, right? Somewhere along the line, he received a promise from his way of talking about God, right? These are ancient peoples and how they understand things, but he got communication from God. His name was changed to Abraham. So it goes from being great father to father of a multitude. He's to be the father of a multitude. And not just to be a father of a multitude, like to become a nation, that sounds like really cool, but with a very explicit job, and that is to be a blessing to the world. Not just have power, not just to be important, but to be a blessing, to begin to change the world. He held on to that promise, and he hoped for it, and he lived for that to happen. But the problem was, hope was running out. Time was running out. He's now 90 years old, and his wife, Sarah, is not much younger, and still no kids. I mean, this is a problem when you're supposed to be a father of a multitude, right? But then finally, he does have one child, Isaac. And he has it, so now he's kind of like just got his fingers into the possibility of this, just a toehold on that promise. And his young son, Isaac, there, and he's like, I don't know how this is all going to happen. It seems like we're up against the odds. Like, I can't imagine it, but I'm still hoping. I'm still going to follow his promise. And then he gets a message. I want you to go to that mountain I will show you in the region of Moriah, and I want you to sacrifice your son. Seriously? Okay, so that's where we pick up on this, all right? But he has a plan. He has always had a plan. And that's what he's following here. So what is his plan? His plan is he trusts Yahweh. He says, Yahweh gives me a hope, gives me a promise, and is the only thing that understands how all this is going to unfold. So whatever Yahweh says, I'll do that. Now, that sounds kind of naive, or I think in our contemporary Christian, we hear that as, well, God has a plan for your life. Just do whatever the Bible tells you. Now, I mean, that's not... One, the Bible didn't exist, right? So there wasn't any of that. But these people saw God as Yahweh, I am who I am, this ethereal thing that connects everything, that is everything, that cannot deny itself. It only is what it is. It can't be anything other. And how can you not follow that? I mean, it's like it's getting a glimpse into the fabric of existence, and whatever the fabric of existence is calling you to, that's what you do, because that's the only thing that ultimately can make sense. So that's his plan. I got to stick with that. If it tells me to follow to the, take my son to a mountain in the region of Moriah and sacrifice him, then I don't know. I gotta do it, right? It's part of my plan. Okay, so let me take you through this again, line by line. I should warn you, this might be all we do this week. You ready for that? All right. So after these things, God tested Abraham. After these things, that's like the continuing narrative, right? There's been a lot of water under the bridge. After these things, God tested Abraham. Hebrew to English, tested. Like it sounds like God's going to find out if Abraham knows the right thing or not. But think of tempered. When you temper steel, you treat it with heat. You're testing it with heat, and you make it stronger. You make it more flexible. He's trying to make Abraham able to do what he is going to need to do to be able to fulfill that promise. So after these things, God tested Abraham, and God said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And then God said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will show to you. Now, remember, no words wasted, no phrases wasted, no details wasted. He didn't say, take Isaac and go. No, take your son, your only son, your only shot at fulfilling your promise. Isaac, let's name him. The one you love, just to rub it in a little bit, okay? Just to rub it in how hard this is going to be, and go do this. And what's more, he starts it out with all these extra words. It could have simply been, God said to him, take your son and go to the land, right? But first of all, he says, God said to him, Abraham. He names him. Now, what does Abraham's name mean? Father of multitude. What language is it written in? Hebrew, which is what that name is. So it's not like, okay, my name is Gregory. Gregory means vigilant or watchful. But when we say Gregory, we just hear Gregory, and sometimes you might remember, oh yeah, my name means this. But what if my name actually, you know, was in English, like his name was in Hebrew, right? So what if every time you talk to me, you would be saying, hey, watchful. And you said, hey, watchful one, let's go to Lake Street and see what is happening. I mean, does that have a different twist? Hey, watchful one, let's go see what is happening. Hey, father of a multitude, take your son, your only son, your only way to the multitude, the one you love, and go sacrificing it. Go sacrifice it. So, Abraham rose early the next day, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. No conversation about what he was feeling, what he was thinking, what was going through. Why don't they tell us that? Because you're going to supply that. It's your hope that you have to figure out, right? It's your struggles, your mountain climbs that you're going to have to deal with. You imagine it. You think it. Let you feel it. So he rose up early in the morning, took two of his young men and his son Isaac. He cut wood for the burnt offering. He set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, all right, so first day, Friday, he gets a message that his son has to be killed. Then there's Saturday, and then Sunday morning, the third day, I don't actually know what day of the week those were, but maybe you catch some of the foreshadowing going on here. On the third day, Abraham looked up. I guess he had never looked up, right, in 3 days. Abraham looked up, and he saw the place far away. He saw the place far away, the place where the promise would be fulfilled, the place where hope would have to either be found or lost. He saw that place far away that his eyes were trained on. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham doesn't lie. He's still hanging on to hope. He could have fudged it. He could have been hopeless and said, watch the donkey. We're going to go up to the mountain, do what we have to do, and then I will come back. Or he could have been more vague and said, watch the donkey. We're going to, go up to the mountain, do what we have to do, and be back. Leader said, no, but he said, and we will return. He is not going to give up on his hope. He is not going to give up on the fact that this promise will be fulfilled. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and he laid it on his son Isaac. Just make sure we get how horrible this had to be. And he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together in what must have been the most awkward walk between a father and a son in human history. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, Father, again, just rubbing things in, remember, this is all one language. He said to his father, Father of a multitude, Father, and he said, Here I am, my son. And he said, The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham says, God will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. He didn't know how hope would be fulfilled. He didn't know if the lamb that God would provide was his son, or if it would be something else. He didn't know. He hoped. He hoped. When they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Now, again, storytellers. We just went from he heard something and next morning he rolls up early and suddenly it's the third day. Like, we pass all of this 24-hour period. It kept going and kept going and kept going. And just condense into a couple words, and then all of a sudden, you notice how everything is slowing down. It's slowing down. He bound his son Isaac, he laid him on the altar on top of the wood, and then just to like slow it down all the more to excruciating detail to know just how hard it is to hold on to hope. Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to kill his son. Like, was it all in slow motion while he's like stalling for time, or are we intended to feel the agony and the desperation, the reach for hope that we don't know whether we have or not? But the angel of Yahweh, I am who I am, called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. The third time. God said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. From who? From what? It's not like God said, you know, I really kind of wanted your son, and I want the blood from his sacrifice. No. And he says, you have not withheld your son from the fulfillment of the process. What Yahweh was to him was the fulfillment of a promise. It was a hanging on to hope. It was learning to live with something that might be possible, but it's going to be so hard to realize. You would not withhold anything in order to reach that goal, to realize that hope. And then he says, I know that you fear God. That word, we could spend a week talking about what that word fear means, but all I can tell you is, because I think your imagination can figure it out just fine, but the one thing that fear does not mean is to be afraid. It does not mean I realize that you are afraid of me. No, it isn't about that at all. So Abraham looked up and he saw a ram. He looked up again. He saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, I am who I am will provide. As it is said today, on the mount of I am who I am, it shall be provided. This is not a story about a sacrifice. It's not a story about testing Abraham to see how loyal or crazy he is to follow this crazy God no matter what. It is a story about how hope plays out. So on the steep slope of hope, going towards a mountain that is being shown to you, when it feels like discouragement and disappointment, hopelessness are all there, not progress, on that mountain, it can happen, and it will happen. You have to hang on to that. There's no magic. It isn't done for you. It isn't like, oh, if you believe in God, everything's going to work out or whatever. No, you've got to climb that mountain. You have to follow your dreams. You can't be discouraged. It will ask everything of you. And that, I think, is why this is laid into a story that is so tragic and so so horrible? It's because sometimes, not every time, thank God, not every time, but sometimes, hope will ask everything of you. Hope will ask absolutely everything of you. And when we need hope the most, it's probably in the times of our lives, the parts of our lives where we feel the most vulnerable, where it is the scariest, where, you know, it is feeling the hardest. But even then, in the most unimaginable, this story is saying, don't give up. Stick with a plan. Hope. The world is woven to make its most sense, to make things happen when we rely on more than just our own single strand, more than what you can do, and more than what even we can do as two strands come together to try to accomplish things that seem too big for ourselves. But when we start to tie into, to weave into that which is part of all things around us, that is part of the fullness of this world, it's like saying, you know, the third day is going to be a doozy, but there is life there. There is life there. Let me leave you with one last detail about this story, and that is Isaac. Anybody know what Isaac's name means? Laughter. Yeah, you would know. They have a boy named Isaac. Okay. Isaac, laughter. I mean, how perfect could this be? The son, the only son whom he loved is Isaac, is laughter. The promise. He's the promise. After the agony of that walk up the mountain, being prepared to do what might be unthinkable, trying to realize that somehow this promise, somehow my hope is going to be fulfilled in a way that seems to be eliminating every avenue I ever had to it, at the end of that comes laughter, comes joy. We go up the mountain and we come down the mountain with joy, with laughter. I mean, the Bible, in my humble opinion, is used really poorly by most people. I mean, we look at it so superficially. We just miss all that stuff, and we need to dwell with it. We need to live in there. We need to realize that this is perhaps one of the most beautiful things that this story is trying to tell us. That, yes, hope has to go uphill and downhill, and it's going to be excruciating. But joy is always going to be part of it. Laughter can be part of it. In fact, you will never make the journey without it.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a Fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wonderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.